I'm taping this for our podcast site on the internet, which has about 2 years plus of the talk, so
feel free to
listen in. So, the baby is born without a functioning part of the brain called the hippocampus, which is the part of the mind that stores our narrative memories. But from the moment we're born, we do have a working amygdala, which is a different form of memory. It's the associative memory. It's a part of the brain that recalls traumatic events, all of the information that occurs during something that we experience as traumatic or possibly very, very important to our survival, both bad and good, is working from the moment you're born. Now, this kind of memory is very difficult to appreciate once you have a fully working brain, once you have declarative memory, because associative memory doesn't have any sequence to it or causation. If a baby gets frightened when the light is turned out and its mother isn't there, and it starts crying and it feels itself cold, the sequence of light turning out, not finding mommy, crying, getting cold, is not stored in the brain in that sequence. It simply associates being cold, crying, no connection, and darkness. There's no order to it. It's simply written into the amygdala that these things are not good. Because the baby, for an infant, the most important thing, along with obviously being fed, is attachment or connection, in the sense that it's being taken care of. Obviously, babies are aware of one thing, which is that they are very much vulnerable to the world, that they can't take care of themselves. We are born, in a sense, prematurely, and that other animals, some animals can pretty much start functioning from word go. Some of us need 30 years before we're capable of that. So, though, it's really important to reflect how important attachment connection is to the baby. There's a remarkable series of studies, clinical work done by Ainsworth and Bowlby, who were capable of observing the mother's connection with the child and the baby and at the six-month period after birth, and were able, with startling accuracy, able to predict whether that infant would grow up to be able to have lasting, sustainable relationships with others, simply by observing its relationship with the mother. Now, we're not trapped by this period of time, but it does play a large role in the formation of our personality. The mother that gives secure attachment is one that mirrors the child's emotional state, lets the child know that whatever it's feeling is okay, and very gradually introduces periods of time when it can be left alone to explore or simply be on its own. It's done very gradually, and at first the mother is very attentive and comes, and then over time gives more and more space for the infant to get used to being on its own. That's secure attachment. Of course, then there's all the way across the scale to the most insecure form of attachment, which is a mother that doesn't emotionally mirror its baby, is completely inattentive, dumps the baby in perhaps a crib without coming at all, and or is completely so caught up in other things in life that it doesn't notice or hear all the time what the baby is experiencing. Most of us like to think we are in one extreme or the other. The truth of it is that while many of us had varying degrees of insecure or secure attachment, no matter how perfect our mothers were, all infancy requires trauma to have occurred. All babies experience at some point the mother not being there, being separated, being put in the arms of a stranger, or being alone. And these core traumas create associative links between not being connected, not being supported, not being seen or looked after, and physical states in the body and other visual experiences or perceptual experiences. So all these things are lodged together. The physical state we're in when we experience not being attached, the visual experience, it's all just associated together. And this is important to remember. I'm going to come back to why it's important to remember. But the child associates what's going on somatically, physically in the body, with what's happening externally. It's a little bit like when you are in a car crash and you're listening to the wonderful Parliament Funkadelic. You're listening to One Nation Under a Groove. This is I'm making this up. This has never happened to me, so don't think, oh, this is something that's happened. No, I'm just making this up. But anyway, the next time you hear One Nation Under a Groove, if you have a car crash, you'll have a traumatic response. The song didn't cause it, but your amygdala just notices everything that's going on during a traumatic event, and the amygdala is not smart enough to notice what thing is causing the trauma. It just stores everything that's going on. So the song Parliament Funkadelic, or wherever you were when you had the car crash or whatever car you saw, can trigger the trauma. That's the way the associative memory works. There's no cause assigned. There's simply things that are lumped in as bad. And if the same things are repeatedly lumped in as bad, they cause an even greater sense of, oh no, this is something I should avoid. Being cold, being in the dark, being alone, being trapped, being not where I can see my parents, whatever. These can become very stored, ingrained traumas for the infant. Now, as we move on to 2 and 5, the child begins to develop narrative sequential memory. The hippocampus starts working. And so we also develop at the same time the ability to use language and thought to explain things. And so when we experience these traumas, these fears, for instance, a re-triggering of the experience of cold or tightness in the body, meaning we're hungry and we're not being fed, or the experience of being left alone or being isolated. When we experience this, we start to add on top of it this whole sense of explanation, why we feel this way. And very often, our explanations are way off base. They can lead to some very startling coping strategies. For example, some children think that the reason they're left alone is because they're not smart enough, or they're not funny when they're around their parents, or they're not cute enough, or they're not being obedient enough, or whatever causal explanation they add on top of why they were experienced abandonment, they will go on then to compensate. They'll learn this lesson that, well, I get left alone when I'm acting this way, so if I act this way, I will get positive attention. And sometimes the infant will mistake all sorts of attention with the goal, acting out in all sorts of ways, stomping its feet, they see, gets the mother's attention, screaming, yelling, crying. Sometimes we learn that this is the way that we get attention from others. Other babies learn that, or children learn that, it's only when they're very quiet and obedient and perfect that they'll get attention. Some children learn, oh, it's when I'm funny and get my mother and father to laugh that I get attention from them. And these strategies for attention can turn into the coping strategies that we use deep into our lives. It's amazing. You can, for example, one of the standard stories any therapist's case studies will be the girl who grows up with a cold, distant father. And so, as she becomes an adult, she dates a succession of cold, distant men. The idea being, if I date the cold, distant man who represents my father, I can get all that love and attention and security and emotional mirroring that I didn't get as a child. Now, of course, what she's doing is setting herself up for disaster, because if the guy remains cold and distant, she doesn't get any love or attention. She just recreates the situation of her childhood. On the other hand, if the man suddenly turns attentive and caring and loving and accepting, she becomes bored with him because he no longer represents the father. She dumps him and finds another cold, distant, uncaring man. So you see, this becomes a cycle that repeats itself into the adult life. Another example is a guy who feels that he didn't get any attention from his parents unless he was extremely funny at the table, got attention, or was theatrical. And so as he grows up, he tries to fill himself with the attention of others by being funny all the time, being performing, being larger than life. There are myriad examples of this, but to a certain degree, until we become insightful of our own behaviors, we are largely acting out, often in our lives, childhood dramas well into our adult lives. Some of us turn these into addictions. Addictions to, for example, sex or relationships, ways to get connected. There's another form, though, of addiction that gets mixed into this equation, which is when we can't get attention, when we just feel that we are too alone or isolated or we'll never get that love that we're seeking or that real connection. The second strategy is to find a way to turn off the mind, to calm the mind, to shut it down at all costs. This becomes the second strategy. We either feed the beast in us that needs love that it didn't get, and attention and security, or B, failing that, we develop strategies to turn off our awareness of just how lonely, sad, different, isolated we feel. And so these turn into addictions of drugs, alcohol, TV addictions, anything that numbs the mind. So we can get caught up in addiction cycles between needing attention and connection through whatever means possible, or B, when that doesn't work, we fall into the second set, which is, how the fuck can I numb myself so I don't feel this sadness, isolation, despair, lack of connection with another human being. So, hopefully, what happens is at one point we experience what the Buddha called Sambhogga, which is we see that our coping strategies aren't working and we look for a way out. If we are real addicts, what we will do is we will reach the point where any normal human being should see, wow, this drinking or this sleeping around or whatever isn't working, and we'll simply move to a different place or give up our friends and hang out in the bar all the time. We'll change the conditions so that our coping strategies will hopefully still work, rather than abandon the coping strategies because they're not working. Anyway, if we're lucky, eventually after we try this strategy of changing the context enough, we see, wow, this shoving my feelings down with food, turning myself off with TV, this attachment to relationships that are not working, this desperately trying to get love from my mother who's not giving it, this mistaking my workplace for a surrogate family. All these strategies eventually, hopefully, we learn are not solving anything. And then we get to a point where there's a possibility of healing. So what does healing look like? Well, it starts with finding a place where we are capable of getting some form of unconditional acceptance. Whether this means a 12-step group, or therapy, or a Buddhist group, or a group of supportive friends, or some people start families and insist on it. But hopefully we find a place where we feel that we are unconditionally accepted. And this is important because so long as we still feel that our acceptance or our worthiness as a human being is conditional upon being perfect or being funny or being smart or being successful or being wise or whatever, it will never truly sink in that we are okay, that we are safe. So we need that sense of, I'm okay here. Then, what the Buddha offers us is a new way to relate to this feelings of aloneness and isolation and trauma and not being connected and not being loved, that when they arise. The important thing now is to recall earlier when we talked about how when an infant experiences something, it stores not only the external perceptions of being alone and the mother not there, but also the physical state. This is important because we can go into the feelings via the body. We can feel the sadness, the isolation, the feeling of not being supported in the safest arena possible, which is in the vessel of our internal experience. We can actually be with this tightness in the stomach, this contraction in the throat, the shoulders suddenly becoming very tight, or the feeling of a tingling up the back of the neck, or whatever, however you experience this sense of being rejected, being fired, being whatever comes up when you really feel this sense of pain, of disconnection, you can go into that and be with it. If it doesn't feel like it's coming up, one of the practices one of the monks taught me is to simply sit, and after a while, when we've been through an experience that's very upsetting, that's causing obsession, repetitive thinking, for instance, suppose we've been fired from a job, whatever. So we sit, and after we get a little calm, we just say, how does it feel to be let go, to be released, to not be wanted? And we don't go into the story. We just simply ask, how does it feel? And we keep on asking this question, and we survey the body until we find some area where the breath feels blocked, or the body starts, we feel this sense of solidity and contraction. And then we sit there and we just keep on saying, okay, what's there? What wants to come up? We've all known in our lives people who get into the 2-week-long relationship, and then the one person says to the other, well, you know, it's not you, it's me. And then, even though it's 2 weeks long, they're utterly destroyed. And we feel, it's tempting to feel, well, that's terrible, but it was only 2 weeks long. Hopefully you don't say that. That's not unconditional support. Hopefully what you say is, yeah, that's terrible. I know how that feels. And you give them permission to go beneath the current story of what's happened right now into the older feeling of, I didn't get love. I didn't get what I needed. I didn't get that feeling of security. A great story from one of my favorite lay teachers is Jack Kornfield talks about when he became a monk. And he was traumatized by these obsessive thoughts about his ex-girlfriend, who he had broken up with a long time before he became a monk. But suddenly the thought over and over and over again hit him, I'm never going to be able to have sex with her or see her again. And he was puzzled by this thought because the relationship was already over. And so he basically just found the area in his body, I believe it was in the solar plexus, that felt this sense of hollowness where the breath, and he couldn't feel any energy there. And he sat with it long enough, and then the wonderful, albeit very sad, thought came up. Something along the lines of, I'll have to reread the where he talked about it in the book, but it came up, nobody loved me when I was a child. And that was what was beneath this fear. If I become a monk, if I give up this relationship, if really give up on it, if I, you know, take on this new choice in life, I'm going to go again through my childhood agony of being not loved. And so a part of him was saying, no, 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 no. And the feelings were getting blocked, so the brain was throwing up the thought, you've got to get back in touch with your ex-girlfriend. You've got to quit this path, because if you go here, you're going to wind up again not being loved. And so the only way to get to those feelings is, or the safest way is through the body. Just find where it's stuck, where we've experienced that trauma associated with, be with it, give it permission, and then feel and be open to whatever deeper, older emotions, thoughts that arise out of it. Then, rather than argue with it, which is our want, oh no, you're wonderful. There's nothing wrong with a couple of pep talks to ourselves, but this is not the time for it. The time for it is simply, right now, is simply to say it's okay. It's simply okay. When we give permission for these feelings that we've been running from, blocking, drinking, being focused on our careers, focused on our Facebook, focused on anything that will push so we don't have to experience this loneliness, this not being accepted, whatever we've been pushing down, when we give permission for it to arise and we stay with it, we don't agree with it, but we don't push it away, we don't argue with it, we just give it space to arise. Eventually, when we can sit with these feelings, we no longer are stuck in the cycle of trying to feed the beast or anesthetize the beast. The woman who grew up in the distant relationship with her father, if she feels that sense of I wasn't really loved or really felt connected to my father, she mourns that loss, she gives that feeling space, then She doesn't go into relationships being driven to feed and get that love because she's mourned it. She's no longer acting out of a traumatic thing from her past. She's now free to find relationships with someone who doesn't represent the father because she's accepted deeply that it's gone. The chance to get that sense of connection from her father has passed. It's never going to happen. We feel it. We mourn for it. We give it permission to be with us. We carry it with us. But then we get on with our lives. So that's what healing looks like. And it's very possible, speaking as a guy who grew up with a crazy alcoholic father and all that, I've been through all of this, and it is very possible to be with the most dark feelings of rejection, and despair, lack of acceptance, support, and to find a new meaningful connection with that, I hate the inner child term, but those feelings of never being truly loved or supported. We can give now a safe place for them. And the good news is that whereas the infant feels like its very life is at stake, because in ways it is when it's not protected, we as adults, even though some of us don't realize it, we actually can be with these feelings without our lives ending. There's room enough in the body, there's room enough in the mind for whatever we've been running away from to arise, for us to be with it, to hold it, to contain it, and give it the attention that we didn't get enough of when we were a child. We now can give these voices the acceptance that they never got. So I thank you for listening. I hope there was something in there that was worth pondering. And now I turn off the...